An Osho Talk. The White Lotus. Talks on the Zen Master Bodhidharma. Number 3.
Question. What is meditation in emptiness? Answer. One observes things in the phenomenal world, yet always dwells in emptiness. That is meditation in emptiness. Question. How can one dwell in Dharma? Answer. One should stay neither in indwelling Dharma nor in non-dwelling Dharma. He should live naturally in Dharma. That is what you call dwelling in Dharma. Question. How can a man live as not man, and a woman as not woman? Answer. There is no difference in Buddha nature between a man and a woman, nor an entity designated as a man or woman. Physical matter produces the grass and the trees as it does human beings. In comparison, you say grass or trees. You give all sorts of names to your illusions. Buddha said, if one sees that everything exists as an illusion, he can live in a higher sphere than ordinary man. Question. If one attains nirvana of an arhat, has he Zen realization? Answer. He is just dreaming, and so are you. Question. If one practices the 6 paramitas and passes through the 10 stages of bodhisattvahood and completes 10,000 virtues, he should know that all things are not born, therefore they are not going to perish. Such realization is neither intuition nor intellectuality. He has nothing to receive, and there is nothing to receive him. Has this man Zen realization? He is just dreaming, and so are you. Question. If a man has 10 powers and accomplishes 4 forms of fearlessness and completes 18 systems of the teaching, he is the same as Buddha who attained enlightenment under the Pipala tree. He can save sentient beings and then enter into nirvana. Is he not a real Buddha? Answer. He is just dreaming, and so are you.
The most important question that man has ever encountered is, what is meditation? The English word meditation is not so pregnant with meaning as the original Sanskrit word dhyana is. Meditation gives a wrong connotation. The moment you say meditation, immediately the idea arises on what? Meditation, in the English sense of the word, is always on some object. But in the Sanskrit sense of the word dhyana, there is no object as such. On the contrary, to be absolutely objectless, to be utterly empty of all content, is dhyana. Hence, when Buddha's message reached to China, the word was left untranslated, because there was no equivalent in Chinese language either. And the Chinese language is far more richer than any language of the world. Yet there was not any word which can be called synonymous with the word dhyana. For the simple reason, such a word was missing, because dhyana has never been practiced anywhere else except this country. This country has contributed only one thing to the world, and that is the art of dhyana. And that one contribution is enough, more than enough. The whole science can be put on one side. Still, it will not be more weighty than the single word dhyana. All the knowledge of the world can be put on one side, but the word dhyana will still weigh more. It has infinite significance. It is a totally new vision of consciousness, a consciousness without content, a consciousness without any thought, desire, an ocean without ripples, waves, utterly silent and still, reflecting the whole sky with all the stars. So is dhyana. In China it was left untranslated. But when you write one word from one language into another language, even if you don't translate it, it changes its color, its form. That's natural. It has happened many times. Now you know the word India. It is simply a different pronunciation for Sindhu, the great river that passes north through Pakistan. When the Persians crossed that river for the first time, they pronounced it as Indu, not as Sindhu. From Indu, it became Indus. From Indus, it became India. And from the same word, Sindhu, some other language group passed and pronounced it not as Sindhu, but as Hindu. Hence, Hindu, Hinduism, Hindustan. But they all have arisen out of the name Sindhu. Now it seems so far away. Hindu and India seem to be not related at all. There was great discussion when Indian constitution was being prepared, what to call this country, India or Hindustan. Great controversy over the same word, because they both arise from the same word, the name of the great river that passes Pakistan now, Sindhu. It travelled in one direction and became Hindu and Hindustan, travelled into another direction, became Indus, India. The same has happened with dhyana. Buddha never spoke Sanskrit. That was also one of his originalities. In India, Sanskrit has always been the language of the priests, of the culture, of the sophisticated. Buddha is the first to bring a radical change. He started talking in the language of the people, because Sanskrit has never been a language of the people. It has always been the language of the highest strata of the society. And they have guarded it with great care so that it never falls into the hands of the common people. It has been one of the strategies of all the priests all over the world that their language should not be understood by the common people. Because if their language is understood by the common people, then they will be exposed. Because what they go on saying is simple, very ordinary. But in a language that you don't understand, it appears as if they are talking something superb, something very supernatural. If you read the Vedas in your language, you will be surprised. There is not much. Not more than 1% of the sutras are significant. 99% is simply rubbish. But if you hear it chanted in Sanskrit, you will be enchanted. You will be simply hypnotized. So is the case with Quran. If you hear it in the Arabic, it will have something magical. Translated into your own language, you will be puzzled. It looks very ordinary. Priests have always been aware that their scriptures can be valued and appreciated and respected and worshipped only if they are not translated into the ordinary people's languages. Buddha is one of the revolutionaries in that sense too. He started talking in the language of the people. The language of the people that surrounded Buddha was Pali. In Pali, dhyana becomes jhana. More rounded, more used. When a word is used more, it starts having a roundness to it. It loses corners. It is like a rock flowing in the river. Slowly, slowly it becomes round, softer. It attains to beauty. It attains to a lovely form. Dhyana is harsh. Jhana is round, soft, easy to pronounce. So when a Buddhist messengers reach China, jhana became chan in Chinese. And when the same word reached from China to Japan, it became Zen. The root is dhyana. In English also there is no equivalent word. Meditation can be used because that is the most approximate. But that has to be used with very great care. Because meditation itself means meditating upon something. And dhyana means being in meditation, not meditating upon something. It is not a relationship with an object. It is absolute emptiness. No object, not even God. Simply objectlessness, the mirror reflecting nothing. The mirror simply in its nature, as it is. When you come to that simplicity, to that innocence, you are in meditation. You cannot do meditation. You can only be in meditation. It is not a question of doing something. It is a question of being. It is not an act, but a state. The disciple asks Bodhidharma, the master, what is meditation in emptiness? He must have been puzzled. Many people ask me, on what we should meditate? On what form? What we should visualize? What mantra we should chant? Or what thought form we should create inside our minds so we can focus on it? They are asking about concentration, but they think they are asking about meditation. And there are thousands of books written on concentration, but they all go on using the word meditation. This is one of the most misinterpreted words. And the experience is so rare that you will never understand that somebody is using the word in an absolutely wrong sense. I have come across hundreds of books which go on using the word meditation as if it is a higher state of concentration. It has nothing to do with concentration. In fact, it is just the opposite of concentration. In concentration, there is an object. You have to focus on the object. You have to be absolutely concentrated on it. Your whole consciousness falling on the object, not missing the object even for a single moment. That is concentration. Concentration has its own value. It is a great method in the hands of science, but it has no religious value at all. It has scientific value. It has artistic value, but no religious value at all. Science cannot move a single step without concentration. Art cannot create without concentration. The artist becomes so much concentrated on his painting, or his sculpture, or music, that he forgets the whole world. In his concentration, everything else is excluded, bracketed out. Only one thing remains in his mind. As if that one thing consists of the whole world. That thing is the whole world for the moment. Nothing else exists. There is an ancient story, a very famous book, one of the greatest ever written, is a commentary on Brahma Sutras, written by Brihaspati. The name of the commentary is very strange. The name of the commentary is Bhamati. It is strange because it has nothing to do with Brahma Sutras, one of the greatest expositions of the philosophy of Advaita, non-dualism. Bhamati is Brihaspati's wife's name. What connection can there be between the commentary on Brahma Sutras and Brihaspati's wife? There is some hidden secret in it. Brihaspati must have been a man of deep concentration, a great philosopher he was. He got married because the father was getting old and he wanted him to be married. And in those old days, obedience was the simple way. It was naturally. So, people used to follow their parents. There was no question of saying no. So Brihaspati said yes. He was married to Bhamati, but he was not a man who needed a wife or needed a family. His whole concentration was on the great commentary that he was writing on Brahma Sutras. He was so absorbed that he brought the wife home and forgot all about her. The wife took every care of Brihaspati. That too is no more possible. And who can take care of such a husband who has completely forgotten? He has no idea who she is, what is her name. He has never asked the name even. She served him like a shadow. She never came in front of him because he may get distracted, disturbed. And he was continuously writing his commentary. He was in a hurry because he has taken a vow inside his heart that the day the commentary is complete, he will renounce the world. And he wanted to renounce the world as soon as possible. Day in, day out he was writing. Late in the night he will go on writing. Sometimes the candle will burn out and the wife will come from the behind. Just put a candle there. Once in a while he will see the wife's hand bringing food, taking away the thali and the plates. But he never inquired, who is this woman? He was so concentrated on his work. It is a beautiful story. Whether it really happened or not, that is not the point. Because I don't think that wives can be so nice, even in those old days. One hopes, but hopes are never fulfilled. Years passed, and the night came when the commentary was completed. Vraspati closed the book. The wife came and removed the candle. Now he was free from the commentary and the absorption. He asked the woman, "Who are you? And why you go on serving me like this?" The woman said, "I am absolutely blessed that at least you asked my name. It is more than I can ask for. You must have forgotten. Many days have passed, and you were so absorbed in your work, how can you remember? How one can expect to remember? I am Bhamati. You had married me a few years before. Since then I have been serving you." And tears rolled down on Vraspati's cheeks, and he said, "Now it is too late, because I had taken a vow that the day the commentary is completed, I will renounce the world. It is too late. I cannot be a husband to you anymore. I have renounced the world." Closing the book is closing this chapter of my life. I am now a sannyasin. But I feel tremendously grateful to you. You are a rare woman. Just in gratitude, I will call my commentary Bhamati. Hence, his commentary on Brahma Sutras is called Bhamati. On the surface, there is no relation between Bhamati and Brahma Sutras. But Vraspati called and said to his wife that this way your story will be remembered for centuries. Yes, many centuries have passed and I have remembered it. And now you will remember it. A rare woman and a rare man and a rare story. This is concentration. Absolute concentration. It is possible to be so concentrated on something that everything else is excluded out. It is said of Thomas Alva Edison, a great scientist, the greatest, because he discovered at least 1,000 things alone. Nobody else has done so much. Many things that you are using are additions, inventions, the electric bulb, the gramophone, the radio, many things. He used to become so much absorbed in his work that once he forgot his own name, it is very difficult to forget your own name. Even if you want to, it becomes so ingrained, it goes so deep in the memory, it becomes part of your unconscious. Even in your sleep, you remember your name. If you all fall asleep here, as you can fall, I can go on and on talking about meditation, what you will do? Where you will escape? You will start falling asleep. If you all fall asleep and suddenly I call somebody's name, I call Mukta, then nobody else will hear. Only Mukta will hear. Mukta will open her eyes and will say, "Who is disturbing?" And why me? Even in deep sleep, you remember your name. It is very difficult to forget it. But Edison forgot once his own name. Somebody else had to remind him. He was standing in a queue in the First World War days. And when his name was called, he looked here and there. The clerk called again. Then a man standing behind him told him that, "As far as I know from the newspapers, I have seen your picture. You appear to be Thomas Alva Edison." He said, "Yes, you are right. I was thinking, who is this man? Sounds as if I have heard this name before. I can recognize the name. But I completely forgot that this is my own name." He said, "I'm very sorry. This can happen to a scientist." He used to keep his notes because he was working on so many things together. And then he will forget where he has put the notes. And he will use on pieces of paper, that was his habit, something eccentric. Just a small pieces of paper he will write great things. His whole study was full of pieces of papers. Every piece of paper had to be preserved because nobody knew what he has written on it. His wife had to take every care that no piece is ever lost, because he asks, "Where is that piece?" And then he goes for hours because there were so many pieces of papers. The wife told him, "Why not you use a copy?" He said, "That's such a great idea. Why you didn't tell me before?" So you used to carry a notebook, but then he will forget the notebook, where he has kept it. His concentration was so total on whatsoever he was working. It is not meditation, remember. Science needs concentration. Meditation is just the opposite of concentration. Concentration means bracketing out the whole world and pouring your consciousness on a single object. Meditation means no object, not at all, nothing to be excluded, nothing to be bracketed out. One simply relaxes, open, alert, available. Available to all that is. The distant call of the cuckoo and the noise of the train and somebody honking his horn and a child giggling. One is available to all, and yet one is far away, transcendental. The first question the disciple asks is, what is meditation in emptiness? He can understand what is meditation, because then he will be able to understand it as concentration. But the condition is in emptiness. That creates the problem. Meditation in emptiness. You have to be utterly empty. No thought, no desire. No object, no content of the mind. You are just an emptiness. Everything passes through you with no hindrance, no block. Winds come and go through the empty temple. Sun rays come and go through the empty temple. People come and pass through the empty temple, and the temple remains empty. Everything comes and goes like shadows passing by. And nothing distracts you. That point has to be remembered. In concentration, everything distracts you. If you are concentratedly working on something, and your wife starts talking to you, that is a distraction. If your child wants to ask a question, that is a distraction. If a dog starts barking in the neighborhood, that is a distraction. If you are trying to concentrate, everything is a distraction. Because concentration is an unnatural state, forced. Hence, anything can distract you. But meditation is a natural, spontaneous flow. Nothing can distract you. That is the beauty of meditation. Distraction is impossible. The dog can bark, and the child can ask a question, and the aeroplanes can go on flying in the sky and making all kinds of noises. Nothing distracts, because you are not concentrating at all. From where you can be distracted? If you are focusing, you can be distracted. If you are not focusing, how you can be distracted? See the point. Meditation knows nothing of distraction. That's its grace, its beauty, its grandeur. Nothing can disturb it. If your meditation can be disturbed, that simply means you are concentrating and you have not yet tasted meditation. Meditation is so vast, it can contain everything, absorb everything, and yet remain empty. The disciple asked, what is meditation in emptiness? The disciple must have thought about meditation in terms of concentration. That's how it always happens. The master says one thing, the disciple understands just something else. That too is a natural process. I'm not complaining about it. It is bound to happen. Because the master speaks from a different plane and the disciple understands from a different plane. Something coming from the heights has to come down to the darkness of the valley, and the valley is bound to affect it. What to say about a master and a disciple dialogue? Even in ordinary dialogue, when you are talking with people, you constantly feel you have not been understood. Sometimes the more you try, the more it becomes impossible. Particularly if you are intimately related with people, a husband talking to his wife, the wife talking to the husband, the parents talking to the children talking to the parents. It seems there is no possibility of communication at all. The husband says one thing, the wife immediately jumps to some other conclusion. The wife says something, the husband starts talking about something else. Their minds are preoccupied. They go on misinterpreting each other. Hence, so much argumentation continues and no understanding at all. He called his doctor and began shouting hysterically, "My 5-year-old son just swallowed a contraceptive. Don't worry, I will be right over. As the doctor was about to leave his office, the phone rang again, and the same caller announced, "Forget it, doc, I have found another one." It is very difficult to know exactly the meaning of the other. Grant had gone to France on vacation, met a pretty French girl, married her, and returned home with his bride to Cleveland. After being in this country only 3 weeks, the poor little Parisian went to a clinic for an operation. On coming out from under the ether, she asked the doctor, "How soon can my husband and I resume our usual sex life? I will have to look in my medical book," gulped the physician. "You are the first patient who has asked me that after a tonsillectomy." You simply don't know about the French. And their ways of love making. I have heard one story. A French professor of sexuology was talking with an American professor of the same subject. They met in a conference. The French was saying there are 100 ways of making love. The American was puzzled. 100? And when the French started relating all the ways, he was more and more puzzled. The 100th way was, the husband is hanging with the chandelier and making love to his wife. The American said there are 101 ways to make love. The French could not believe it. He said that is not possible, because nobody knows more about love than us. But the American insisted that there are 101. So the French said, "Yes, okay, you start relating." The American said the first is wife lying down on her back and the husband on top of her. The French said, "Wait, I never thought about it." Different people, different minds, different conditionings, different preoccupations, different prejudices. So when you talk, the words can't have the same meaning. When you say something, you say with one meaning. When it reaches to the other, it has the meaning that he can give to those words. This is so in ordinary conversation. What to say about when a Buddha talks to a disciple? The Buddha is standing on the other shore, and the disciple is on this shore. The Buddha is awakened and the disciple is fast asleep and snoring. The Buddha speaks as an awakened one and the disciple listens as one who is asleep. In his dreams, he distorts the meaning. He gives his own ideas, imposes his own ideas. concepts, philosophies upon the words, his own conclusions. Hence, unless the master and disciple relationship is of deep love affair, communication is not possible. It is impossible. Only in a deep, deep loving relationship, in deep intimacy, where the disciple is simply in a let go, he puts his mind aside and listens, not interfering at all, never giving his own meanings, just listening attentively, not being bothered whether what is said is right or wrong, or what does it mean, then only he can listen. And that listening can be a transforming experience. From the disciple's side, great silence is needed. Only then what the master speaks can be understood. The disciple's question is, what is meditation in emptiness? He must have heard Bodhidharma talking again and again about meditation, because in the East, masters have been talking only about meditation. You can ask any question. They will bring the subject to meditation sooner or later. And it is going to be sooner than later. You ask about God and they will talk about meditation. You ask about who am I and they will talk about meditation. You ask about who created the world and they will talk about meditation. Because the East knows the key. Meditation is the key to all the mysteries of life and existence. Hence it is pointless to go on talking about other subjects. If we can make the disciple understand what meditation is, then he is going to unlock all the doors on his own, and he will be able to see and experience on his own. And only your experience is liberating, because then it is authentically your truth. Jesus says truth liberates. Certainly, truth liberates. Absolutely, truth liberates. I agree with him. But his statement seems to be only half. The full statement should be, truth liberates, but the truth has to be your own. If it is somebody else's truth, rather than liberating, it binds you. It chains you. It imprisons you. Bodhidharma says, one observes things in the phenomenal world, yet always dwells in emptiness. That is meditation in emptiness. A simple answer. Just the essential answer. But if you can understand the answer in an existential way, you will never be the same again. Simple words. But they can become a ladder to the other worlds. One observes things in the phenomenal world, yet always dwells in emptiness. That is meditation. See the whole world as if it consists of shadows. It really consists of shadows. It is made of dream stuff. Because we believe in it, it gains reality in the same proportion that we believe in it. The moment your belief disappears, the thing that you believed in also disappears. You see a woman and you project beauty on her. And she looks so beautiful, so golden, not of this world at all. And you fall in love. And you are falling in love with your own dream, remember. The woman has nothing to do with it. That's why lovers are thought to be blind and mad. Because nobody else can agree with them. Majnu was mad after a woman, Leela. So mad that never has there been such a mad lover. He tops the list. The king of the country called him because he started feeling sorry for this young man. And because he was so much in love with Leela, even the king had become interested. Who is this woman? He was also interested in beautiful women. He made inquiries. He saw the woman and he was shocked. She was just very plain, homely, very ordinary. Then he felt even more sorry for this young man, that he is just a fool, a mad, or gone blind, or what has happened to him. And he was the most intelligent young man in the capital, beautiful, healthy, destroying his health, destroying his intelligence for an ordinary woman. The king called him in the court. He said, "You must be mad because I have seen your Leela. She is just an ordinary woman. But I feel sorry for you. We have been hoping much from you. We were thinking you will become a great man, but you are destroying yourself. I will give you one of the best women from my family. I have many beautiful women." He called a dozen girls and he told Majnu, "You can choose any and that is yours." Majnu looked from one girl to another and nodded his head, said, "No, this is not Leela. This too is not Leela." He rejected all the 12 girls. He said, "No one is Leela." The king said, "You are certainly mad. Leela is nothing compared to these beautiful girls. They belong to the royal family." Majnu said, "Sir, I can understand your compassion for me, but I am sorry to say it, that you cannot see Leela unless you see her through my eyes." This is a significant statement. From a madman, of course, but sometimes mad people make very sane statements. "Unless you see from my eyes," Majnu says, "you will not be able to see the beauty of Leela." In a way, he is true. Because the beauty is not there in Leela, it is projected through his eyes. Leela is just the screen on which he is projecting a certain idea. Every lover is doing it. You fall in love with your own projection. That's why it is always frustrating. If you happen to get your woman or your man, you will be frustrated. Blessed are those who never get their man or their woman, because they never get frustrated. They always remain loving. They always go on hoping. Cursed are those who succeed, because then it is very difficult to go on carrying the old projection. When you come closer to the screen and you touch the screen, how long you can feel that there is beauty? Sooner or later you will see there is only plain screen you have been projecting. Hence all lovers, if they succeed, become very frustrated. This world consists of our projections. In fact, when Bodhidharma talks about the world, he is talking only about your projections. He is not talking about the trees and the rocks and the mountains and the stars. He is talking about your projections. The rose is a rose is a rose, neither beautiful nor ugly. It simply is itself. You project your idea. Just 100 years before, nobody has thought that cactuses are beautiful. But now, they are in and the rose is out. Now to talk about roses looks a little old-fashioned. If you tell to your woman that your face is like a rose, she will think you are just old hat. Tell her you look like a cactus. And she will think, yes, you are modern, up to date. You understand Picasso and Dali and modern art. Now people are keeping cactuses in their drawing rooms. They used to put the cactuses only on the fences of their fields and gardens to protect. Now the cactus has entered into the drawing room. Suddenly the beauty is discovered. For centuries nobody has ever thought. Neither Shakespeare nor Kalidas. Neither Milton nor Tennyson. Nobody had ever talked about cactus and praised cactus. But now, we have started projecting beauties on the cactus. We are tired of the roses. Enough is enough. Thousands of years and we have talked everything about the roses. We are finished. Nothing new can be said about the roses. All that could be said has been said, and said so beautifully that there is no way to improve upon it. And we have a great need to project. Hence fashions change. Because everybody has a need to project his ideas. Hence we need new screens. And the idea of beauty goes on changing. In every country there is a different idea of beauty. What is beautiful to an American is not beautiful to the Indian. And what is beautiful to the Indian is not beautiful to the African. And what is beautiful to the African is not beautiful to the Chinese. Different ideas. Then is there something like objective beauty? There is none. Existence is simply there with no adjective. There is neither good nor bad. There is neither beautiful nor ugly. Hence, Bodhidharma says, drop likings and dislikings. Stop choosing. Stop projecting. And the world disappears. Not that the trees will not be there and the mountains will not be there. Not that you will be able to pass through the walls. The walls will be there and the trees will be there and the mountains will be there and everything will be there in its absolute truth. But your dreams will not be there at all. And we have become so much attached with our dreams. That's why meditation seems to be difficult. Patient, doctor, all right, all night long, I dream about baseball. And that happens night after night. Psychiatrist, well, that can be easily remedied. Do you have any favorite actress? Patient, yes, Elizabeth Taylor. Psychiatrist, well, then all you do is think of her at night. Patient, what? And lose my turn at bait? I have heard Mullah Nasruddin one night nudged his wife in the bed and said, quick, bring my specs. The wife said in the middle of the night, what do you want your specs for? He said, don't waste time. Bring my specs. But the wife insisted that first I have to know why, for what. In the middle of the night, what you are going to see? Mullah said, you are going to destroy the whole thing. I was just seeing a dream. Three beautiful women. Elizabeth Taylor, Sophia Loren. Two I could recognize. Third, the most beautiful I could not recognize. Bring my specs. You know that my eyes are not that as they used to be. I'm getting old and I can't see things clearly. People are living in dreams. There are only two kinds of people in the world. Those who live in dreams and those who live in awareness. To be a sannyasin means the beginning of living in awareness. Bodhidharma says one observes things in the phenomenal world yet always dwells in emptiness. One goes on seeing shadows, dreams, projections, but remembers that all this is just dream stuff. Remembering it, deep down one remains utterly empty. The mirror never clings to any reflection. Howsoever beautiful the face may be looking into the mirror, it never clings to it. The face is reflected. When the person has moved, the face disappears. The mirror remains empty. So is the meditator. He reflects everything and yet remains empty because he clings not. The second question, how can one dwell in dharma? Bodhidharma says, one should stay neither in indwelling dharma nor in non-indwelling dharma. He should live naturally in dharma. This is what you call dwelling in dharma. Bodhidharma's way of expression may seem a little strange, but he can't help it. He has to say it as it is. The disciple asks how one can dwell in dharma. By dharma, remember, ordinarily it is translated as religion. That too is not right. Dharma is not religion. Religion is an attitude towards reality. Dharma is not an attitude towards reality. Dharma is simply living naturally, spontaneously. To live in tune with nature is dharma. That is Bodhidharma's experience. That is my experience too. To live naturally, without interfering with your spontaneity. To live moment to moment, without being dominated by the past or the future, is dharma. Bodhidharma says, forget about indwelling dharma and non-dwelling dharma. That is bringing your mind in, creating categories. Live simply and naturally. A Zen master is reported to have said when asked, what is dharma? He said, when I feel hungry, I eat. And when I feel sleepy, I sleep. What a tremendously beautiful answer. What height, what depth. One will never expect such an answer. But so simple, so innocent. When I feel hungry, I eat. The master is saying, be natural. That is dharma. Another Zen master was asked, before you became enlightened, what you used to do? He said, I used to chop wood and carry water from the well. And then he was asked, now that you have become enlightened, a Buddha, what you do? He said, what else I can do? I chop wood and carry water from the well. The questioner was naturally puzzled. He said, then what is the difference? Before enlightenment, you used to do the same thing. After enlightenment, you are doing the same thing. Then what is the difference? And the master laughed and he said, the difference is great. Before I have to do it, now it is all naturally happening. Before I had to make effort, before I became enlightened, it was a duty to be fulfilled, somehow done, grudgingly, reluctantly. I was doing it, because I was ordered to do it. It was my master's order to chop wood, so I was chopping. But deep down I was angry, that how long this old fool is going. To force me chop wood, carry water from the well. How long? Although on the surface I was not saying anything. Now, I simply chop wood because I know the beauty of it, the joy of it. I carry the water from the well. Because it is needed. It is no more a duty. It is my love. I love the old man. It is getting cold. Winter is just knocking on the doors. We will need wood. The master is getting every day older and older. he needs more warmth. We will have to heat his place. It is out of love that I chop wood. It is out of love that I carry water for him from the well. But now, a great difference has happened. There is no reluctance, no resistance. There is no ego. I am not following anybody's orders. I am not being obedient. I am simply responding to the moment and its necessity. Bodhidharma says, to live naturally is to dwell in dharma. You need not be a Christian or a Hindu or a Buddhist. You have only to be natural. Just as natural as you breathe. Live your life. Don't live according to certain commandments. Don't live according to others' ideas. Don't live because people want you to live that way. Listen to your own heart. Be silent and listen to the still small voice within and follow it. And that is dwelling in dharma. The third question, how can a man live as not man and a woman as not woman? Buddha has said, the deeper you go, the more you become aware that you are not the body, you are not the mind, you are not even the heart, you are only a being, a consciousness, a pure witness. Hence, in meditation there is nobody who is a man or a woman. In meditation, you are so deep in your being. From that peak, all differences, biological differences, physiological differences disappear. Bodhidharma says, there is no difference in Buddha nature between a man and a woman, nor an entity designated as man or woman. Physical matter produces the grass and the trees as it does human beings. In comparison, you say grass or trees. You give all sorts of names to your illusions. Buddha said, if one sees that everything exists as an illusion, he can live in a higher sphere than ordinary man. The ordinary man lives in the body, thinking that he is the body. In the mind, thinking that he is the mind. The moment you start transcending body-mind complex, you start becoming extraordinary. You start living on higher planes. And from higher planes, things are totally different. There is a story in Buddha's life. He was meditating under a tree. It was full moon night. A group of young men had come for a picnic to the forest. They had brought a prostitute with them and much wine and delicious food. They drank, they ate, they danced. They drank so much that they forgot all about the prostitute. The prostitute escaped. But she had to escape naked, because before they started drinking, they had taken her clothes away. As the night was coming closer and closer to the morn, cool breeze started blowing, and they became a little alert, and they remembered, where is the prostitute? Her clothes were there, but she was missing. So they went for a search. There was only one way for the prostitute to escape to the town. And they remembered that they had seen a certain man meditating under a tree. So they went to the man. She must have passed the man. They were not aware that he is Gautam the Buddha. They asked Buddha, "Sir, have you seen a naked woman, a beautiful woman, going towards the town? Because this is the only path possible. We had brought a woman with us, she has escaped, and she was naked." Buddha said, "Yes, somebody did pass, but it is impossible for me to say whether the person who passed was a he or a she. Yes, somebody did pass, but it is difficult for me to say whether the person was naked or clothed." The young people were puzzled. They said, "If you have seen the person, you must have seen, because the woman was really beautiful. You must have seen that she is a woman. And you must have seen that she is naked." Buddha said, "You have come a little late. I used to see before women, men, and of course, when you see a naked woman, how can you not recognize? But those days are gone. I was in meditation. So when somebody passed, I was bound to see." Buddha used to meditate with half eyes open. He always followed the middle course. There are three possibilities. You can meditate with closed eyes. Buddha has said, don't do that. Because every possibility is you will fall asleep. With closed eyes, the tendency of the mind is to fall asleep, to go in a reverie, in dreams. Because for centuries, for lives together, closed eyes have become associated with sleep and dreaming. So the moment you close your eyes, immediately it triggers a process of sleep in you. It is very difficult to remain awake with closed eyes. So Buddha has said, don't do that. The other possibility is concentrate with open eyes, but that is concentration. Concentration can be done with open eyes. You can focus your eyes on something. But meditation is a relaxed state. With open eyes, fully open eyes, there will be a certain tension in the eyes. And the eyes are part of your brain. Your 80% brain energy functions through the eyes. If eyes are tense, your brain will be tense. That's why, if you have to watch TV for hours, you become so tired. You go to the movie, and for hours you go on seeing, you forget blinking. That's why you become tired. You can't blink, you can't afford. So much is happening on the screen. You don't want to miss any of it. So you drop blinking. For 3 hours, unblinking, looking at the screen is bound to tire your eyes and your brain too. Now, recent research shows that people who are watching TV for 4, 5, 6 hours a day are bound to suffer some brain damage. There is every possibility they will become victims of brain cancer. So much tension is bound to create damage to the very delicate and fragile nervous system of your brain. Buddha said, meditate with half eyes open. That is the most relaxed state. You can't see anything clearly, everything becomes vague. And that's what Buddha wants you to know, that everything is vague, shadowy, dreamy. You cannot fall asleep because you have to keep your eyes half open, and you cannot be tired and tense because you are not forcing your eyes to be fully open. Half open eyes is the most relaxed state. Try it and you will see. Whenever you sit with half open eyes, you will feel a great relaxation descending on you. So Buddha said, I was meditating, half eyes open, somebody passed, certainly somebody passed, but I can't make any distinction whether the person was a man or a woman. Because I am no more identified with my own body. Hence, I don't think in terms of the body for others too. And who cares whether the person was naked or clothed? Because I am not interested in their bodies. Ordinarily, just the opposite happens. When you see a beautiful woman passing by, you start disrobing her, at least in your mind. You start penetrating her clothes. You start visualizing her, how she will be when she is naked. That's why a woman hidden behind clothes is far more beautiful than when she is naked. For a certain reason. When she is clothed, your imagination can imagine anything. You have full freedom to imagine. But when she is naked, there is no scope for imagination left. And man's sexuality is rooted in his imagination. So whenever a woman is hiding her body, you become more interested in her. Because you start imagining. The curves which may not be there. The proportion which may not be there. Clothes are very deceptive. Clothes have been discovered to create more sexuality in the world. It is because of clothes people are obsessed with the sexual. If clothes disappear from the world, sexuality will be reduced to its natural proportion. If clothes disappear from the world, nobody will be interested in pornography. Pornography is interesting because of clothes. If people become a little more natural, I'm not saying that go to your office naked. But if people are natural, then at least in their home they will be naked. With their children they will play naked, at least in their own garden. If children know their parents naked from the very beginning, they will never be interested in magazines like Playboy. Those magazines will look stupid. But priests are against nudity. It seems there is a conspiracy between the priests and the people who deal in obscenity. There is a secret deal. Obscenity can exist only. Obscene things remain interesting only if priests go on condemning nudity. Allow nudity on all the beaches, and soon you will see nobody is interested in nudity at all. And because imagination has no more freedom, you see things more as they are. Right now you imagine. Hence, the neighborhood woman is more interesting to you than your own wife. Your neighbor is more interested in your wife than he is interested in his wife. It seems everybody is interested in everybody else's wife, everybody else's husband. Nobody is interested in one's own wife or husband. You already know the whole geography of the woman or the man. You know the whole topography. Now there is nothing to discover. It is a known territory. Imagination dies, and with imagination 99% sex disappears. And it will be a great thing in the world if 99% sexuality disappears, because then your 99% energy will be available for higher purposes. What I am saying is bound to be misunderstood, is being misunderstood. For years I have been saying these things, but I have been condemned for these things. And the irony is that if I am listened to, I will prove the greatest danger to sexuality in the world. If I am allowed, the world can become absolutely non-sexual. Sex will be there, but sexuality will disappear. Sex is a biological phenomenon. Sexuality is a psychological phenomenon. In a primitive society where people are nude, there is sex, but no sexuality. And in cultured society, there is sexuality and not much sex. Buddha said, because I am no more interested in sexuality, hence somebody certainly passed, but I cannot say absolutely, I cannot guarantee that the person was a woman. Meditation means going deeper and deeper, closer to your being. Being is neither man nor woman. Being is simply transcendental to all categories. The fourth question, if one attains the nirvana of an arhat, has he Zen realization? The disciple is still thinking in terms of the mind, in categories. When you think, you are always full of ifs and buts. When you know, there is no if and no but. The disciple asks if one attains the nirvana. In the first place, nirvana is never attained. It is your nature. It is simply discovered, remembered rather. It is not attained. And nirvana of an arahat. The Buddhist scholars divide nirvana in two categories. The scholars cannot remain without creating categories. That is their whole work, their whole function. There are two kinds of Buddhas, according to the scholars. One is called Arhata, the other is called Bodhisattva. Arhata is one who attains Buddhahood and disappears into the ultimate, does not care about others, does not bother about sharing his insight with others. And the Bodhisattva is one who attains Buddhahood but resists the temptation to disappear into the ultimate and helps people, is compassionate. Now, even in Nirvana, the mind of the scholar has created a category. He has created a division, a duality. Bodhidharma simply answers in his own unique, inimitable way. He says he is just dreaming, and so are you. These scholars are dreamers. A real seeker has nothing to do with ifs and buts. A real seeker does not bother what happens after nirvana. First he moves towards it, knows it by his own experience. And then whatsoever happens, happens. One becomes natural and allows it to happen. One remains in a let go. One does not go on thinking and philosophizing. The fifth question, if one practices the six paramitas and passes through the 10 stages of bodhisattvahood and completes 10,000 virtues, he should know that all things are not born, therefore they are not going to perish. Such realization is neither intuition nor intellectuality. He has nothing to receive and there is nothing to receive him. Has this man Zen realization? All speculative questions, questions out of the mind. Irrelevant, insignificant, meaningless, absurd. But they look great questions. And scholars devote their whole lives on such questions. In the Middle Ages, there was a great controversy in Christian theologians. Still, the controversy is there, indecisive. No conclusion has been yet reached. But the whole thing started looking so foolish that the project has been dropped. But for 300 years in the Middle Ages, the controversy was such that the whole Christian world was involved in it. The problem was, how many angels can dance on one needle point? Now it looks foolish. But it was not foolish to those people. And they were great scholars, people who know scriptures, subtleties of logic. For them it was really a great question. Because angels don't have any weight. And angels have the capacity to become big or small as they wish. So how many angels you can accommodate on a single needle point? Now you will throw the question into the dustbin. But for 300 years people remain concerned with it. These questions are of the same type. If one practices the 6 paramitas, 6 methods of being perfect, and Buddha say you are already perfect, so there is no question of practicing perfection. And one who practices perfection will remain imperfect. His perfection will be just on the surface. Deep down he will be imperfect. He will repress his imperfections and cultivate a kind of perfection and will remain divided. He is not truly perfect. You cannot be anything else than you are. You are already perfect. You are gods in disguise. You are Buddhas asleep. Wake up and there is no need to practice anything. In your dream you can go on practicing 1001 things and nothing is going to happen. When you will wake up, you will find that all that effort was useless. Now these 6 paramitas and passes through the 10 stages of bodhisattvahood. There are no stages at all. Are there stages between sleep and awakening? There are no stages. Either you are asleep or you are awake. It is a jump, a quantum leap. Are there stages when water evaporates? There are no stages. At 90 degrees, the water is water. At 99 degrees, the water is still water, although hot. At 90.9 degrees, the water is still water, although utterly hot. And one step more, just one step, one single jump, and the water evaporates. There are no gradual stages in evaporating. A man either is alive or dead. You never find somebody who is half dead and quarter dead and 1/10 dead. It is not attained in parts. I have heard a story in the Second World War. An English general shot down a German plane. The pilot was very much wounded. The English general talked to the pilot. He was also a general. So he gave him all respect due to a general of the enemy. He was taken to the hospital, taken care of. His one leg was so damaged that it has to be cut, amputated. The English general asked the German, "Can I be of any help?" The German said, "This will be something of great compassion towards me if you can send my leg back to my home. Because this has been the longest desire in me, to be buried in my own fatherland. The English general said that is not a problem at all. They packed the leg, sent it to Germany, to his home. But then one of his hand had to be cut. That too was sent. Then another leg, then another hand. When the last hand was being sent, the English general asked, "Can I ask you a question? Are you trying to escape part by part?" You cannot escape part by part. And you cannot become enlightened part by part. It is not a gradual process. It is sudden enlightenment. But scholars need some work. So they go on dividing. Buddhas go on saying that it is a quantum leap. And scholars go on dividing. There are 10 stages of bodhisattvahood and 10,000 virtues. One virtue is enough, awareness. They talk about 10,000 virtues. There is only one virtue, to be awake. All else follows on its own accord. The disciple asks, he should know then that all things are not born. Therefore, they are not going to perish. Such realization is neither intuition nor intellectuality. He has nothing to receive and there is nothing to receive him. Has this man Zen realization? Bodhidharma says, he is just dreaming, so are you. Bodhidharma does not even bother to answer and explain. He is not a philosopher. He simply puts the question aside. He said, "Don't talk nonsense. You are dreaming. And not only you are dreaming. If there is somebody who thinks that he is on the 9th stage of bodhisattvahood, he is dreaming too. If somebody thinks that he has fulfilled all the 6 paramitas, all 6 perfections, he is dreaming too. In fact, the person who thinks that I have attained Buddhahood is simply dreaming. Because Buddhahood is not something to be attained. And when you reach to that realization, you simply become aware that there was nothing to attain from the very beginning. From the very beginning you are a Buddha. You have always been a Buddha. Just you had fallen asleep. Just you had forgotten who you are. It is only a question of remembering, of recognizing, of rediscovering. The last question, if a man has 10 powers and accomplishes 4 forms of fearlessness and completes 18 systems of the teaching, he is the same as Buddha who attained enlightenment under the pipla tree. He can save sentient beings and then enter into nirvana. Is he not a real Buddha? Bodhidharma must be feeling very sorry for this man. Because he goes on asking the same question in different ways. It is the same stupidity called a scholarship.
Again and again he brings the same question in a different form. But the masters are always patient. They have to be. Otherwise, it is impossible to work with the disciples. Bodhidharma again says, he is just dreaming, so are you. A simple statement, but with great potential. The moment you start thinking you have become enlightened, beware. If you think you have become enlightened, then you have not become yet. If you think you have become a Buddha, and you start proving that you have become a Buddha, know perfectly well you are not yet. A Buddha needs no proof. He does not argue for it. He simply knows it. And there is no way to prove it. And he knows it, that it is not something great that he has done, not a big deal. It is a simple phenomenon. He has looked in. He could have looked any time, any day, and he would have found the Buddha inside. When Buddha became enlightened, the first question that was asked to him was, "What have you attained?" He laughed. He said, "Nothing. I have not attained anything. On the contrary, I have lost many things." Naturally, the questioner was shocked. He said, "We have always been hearing that to become a Buddha is to attain the perfect, the ultimate, the eternal. And you are saying that rather than attaining anything, you have lost many things. What do you mean?" Buddha said, "Exactly what I have said. I have lost my ego. I have lost my knowledge. I have lost my ignorance. I have lost my being a man. I have lost my body, my mind, my heart. I have lost thousands of things and I have not gained a single thing. Because whatsoever I have gained has always been mine. It is my nature. The unnatural has been lost and the natural has blossomed. It is not an attainment at all. To think in terms of attainment is to remain in a dream." Bodhidharma is right. He is just dreaming and so are you. Remember these words of Bodhidharma. Let them resound in your being, because you will many times dream these things. Many people go on writing to me, "Bhagwan, this has happened. Is this the first satori? Are the second? Are the third? I have experienced great light. How far I am from Buddhahood now? Every day, people go on asking. Remember Bodhidharma. Next time such a question arises in you and you start writing a letter to me, don't send it to me. Just write on top of your letter, 'I am dreaming.'" Enough for today.